Okay, so we have an exam Thursday at 8 in the morning in Bauschalem 109. Your formula sheet drill is the same as last time, and I will try to send the formula sheet out maybe tonight. And just a reminder, I omitted putting this on the chapter list when I sent out material. Other things would have covered it, but relativity is fair game. Today, I've scheduled a Q&A session at 3. That may not be ideal for... Well, it doesn't matter. Which time I choose, it's not going to be ideal for some of you. I have a room, which is Bauschalem room 407, and I'll certainly try to answer any questions you have. Any questions on the exam, Joe? Okay. About the presentation projects. Once you're back at after Thanksgiving, it's going to be a real slippery slope to the end of the semester, and the presentations basically will be very quick once you're back. They'll seem to happen right away. You kind of have to look at the calendar to figure out exactly what the days are. There's a lot going on usually for most of you that time of semester. So I would fully expect most of you to be entirely focused on, in terms of this class, on the exam this week up until Thursday. But I would like you to start talking as a group and get together early next week and think about what it is you may want to do and how it is that you're going to pare down your very broad topic into something that's reasonable to present in 20 minutes and will make sense. Then what I would like you to do, so I'm not constantly having to shoot broad emails out to everybody, if you would just appoint someone in your group to be the contact person, to just let me know what's going on and to work with the group and me to set up a time for all or most of the members of your group to sit down with me and tell me what it is you're thinking and let me try to help you where I can. And it would be really great if we could try to have all that done before Thanksgiving break. So I'd like you to get it moving next week, okay? Anything on that?
All right.
So last time we started what I think is my favorite topic, and one of my favorite topics in physics, actually, but in electromagnetism it certainly is, and it's called induction. And what we found was that if we have a changing magnetic field that can induce an EMF, that is a voltage that we can measure in a wire if you change the field going through it. But in fact, it will also induce it in space. And so we have this relationship which quantifies induction, and we say the induced EMF is equal to E dot VL, which is sort of what you mean about by an induced EMF as you go around the loop. And that's equal to minus d phi m over dt, where phi m is the magnetic flux through that loop. So you define the magnetic flux really the way that we always have. So you have some loop, and it has an area, and there will be a normal to the area, and you calculate b dot dA and sum it up over the interior of that loop. And the real, you know, it's really cool. This is true in a wire. You actually do induce the voltage, but it also is true in free space, which we'll find has a lot of implications. So one thing is this minus sign may seem a little mysterious. I think you saw last time that if I inserted a magnet, I would get a voltage induced one direction, and when I pulled it out, it would be induced the other way. So it turns out that direction is very important in this, and the minus sign basically gives you that. But I don't know if you do this when you do spring problems, but you know the force law for springs, in the vector laws, vector F is equal to minus K times sort of the distance you go, the X vector. And the minus sign is there to tell you it's a restoring force. If I pull the spring, extend it this way, it's going to pull back. And mathematically, it gives you that. But practically speaking, in almost all the problems, what you want to do is to think about which direction the spring is being pulled and know it's a restoring force and put the direction that the spring is going to pull or push into the problem. And if you start thinking too hard about that stupid minus sign, you might get that flipped the wrong way. I find that Physics 113 students, for example, are very confused by this because some of them want to take the equation as something chiseled in stone. And yeah, it works, but if you're doing a Newton's law problem, if you get too religious about that minus sign, you're going to end up with something flipped. So it's better to actually think about, look at the problem and say, well, the spring is pulling that way, so I will draw the spring force that way, and it just makes more sense. This is a little bit like that. What this minus sign means is it gives you an indication of the direction of the EMF. But you really, most of the time, will want to think your way through it rather than actually mathematically worry about that minus sign. And here's the rule you use. It's called Lenz's law. So this is what we wrote last time, the last page. And Lenz's law tells you the direction of the EMF. So the direction of the EMF, if it induces a current, so an induced current would be a current which would be induced by the EMF. So if I say I have an induced current, then that makes sense. If I ask you about the direction of the induced EMF, think of that as the direction which the current would be induced, right? So an induced current in a closed conducting loop will appear in such a way as to oppose the change that created. And this is how it gives you the direction of the induced effect. So what does that mean? Let's suppose that I have a wire, a circular wire in space. And let's say that I have a magnetic field coming out at you that is going through the wire. And let's say that the magnetic field is increasing in strength. Is the current going to be induced clockwise or counterclockwise? Lenz's law tells you that the current will be induced in such a direction as it will fight the change that created it. So if B is increasing, the current is going to be induced in such a direction that it will oppose that increasing B. Okay? So if B is increasing coming out, I want the current will be induced in such a way that it gives B going into the board, which means it will be a clockwise current. Okay, so that's the kind of sort of thinking you have to go through for Lenz's law. You get used to it. I think initially it's easy to get confused with it some. So let's suppose I have a magnetic field that is going into the board. And let's say that I have a conducting wire loop that is moving with a velocity v that direction. Is this going to be clockwise, counterclockwise, or no induced current in the loop? think it's clockwise, raise your hand. Counterclockwise, no induced current. No opinion at all. That's the majority. I didn't see an overwhelming number of hands either way. Here's the loop. I have a flux, which is this field that's interior of the loop. If the loop is moving this direction, the amount of flux in that loop is decreasing. So it will induce a current such that the B field will increase that flux. If I have a clockwise current in that loop, the B interior of the loop is going in the direction of the current field. So it will increase the flux. So that's going to be clockwise. Now, not all answers are clockwise, so don't pick that out of these examples. Yeah.
When you're doing these lenses, a lot of things, you just ignore any magnetic field outside of the loop because
it's the flux through the loop.
Because it would actually be closing the magnetic field. Closing.
Yeah, I mean, there are times you have to worry about the flux. Loop a wire in the plane, I is increasing. What is the direction of the induced current in the right hand loop? Produces a field interior in the loop given by your right hand rule. If I is increasing, I know that the field in the interior is coming out at you and getting stronger. Because it's coming out at you here, I know that outside of this loop it's going into the board, which means outside of the loop, if I is increasing, I have an increasing magnetic field going into the board. It will induce a current in this loop such that it will fight that increasing B going in, which means it wants to produce a field coming out, which means it will be counterclockwise. A little convoluted. It's actually very easy once you get used to it, but it's a little bit of, there are a lot of little places to drop the ball if you're not thinking about it. Okay, so that's a little boring. Let's do something exciting. I need two volunteers. And you are?
William.
William. And you are? Cody. William and Cody. All right. So, William? Cody? William and Cody are going to have a race. They're going to take these devices, which are just plastic plugs with blue tape. Actually, they're aluminum. And that one has a magnet in it. This one does not. And they're going to race them down this aluminum tube. All right? Here. What do you see?
Nothing.
Just an aluminum tube, right?
Definitely feels like it.
Okay. All right, Cody. C comes before W. I would like you to take yours. Don't throw it. Just put it at the top and release it.
That's good.
Who's got fast reflexes and a good stopwatch on their phone? All right. You get him a count of three on your dock.
Okay.
Ready?
3, 2, 1.
0.69. Okay, good enough.
It's loud.
Good. Same thing.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
Never mind, it's dry. 1.
Okay.
All right.
3, 2, 1,
go. Go ahead.
7.88. There's got to be some sort of appearance. There's got to be some sort of aesthetic appearance.
What's going on?
I'm just better.
No,
he's better.
No, that's definitely not the case.
All right, Mr. Better.
I'm good.
Good.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, go.
What's going on? The only difference is that one of them has a magnet.
Maybe it's a close by a metal plate.
That plate's pretty far out here.
Still close.
Magnet field inside them?
Okay. All right. So what happens? If it had a wooden tube, it wouldn't work. Yes?
As the magnet goes down, it induces a current on the aluminum, which is a conductor, and that current makes a magnetic field that opposes the magnet.
Yeah, that's what's happening. As it goes down, you're increasing the magnetic field basically around the loop of this thing. So it induces what are called eddy currents. So it induces a current, and the direction of that current is such that it fights that field, which means you literally are developing an opposing magnetic field. So it's like taking two north poles, which will oppose it. It isn't perfect in the sense that the gravity of winter thing. So, I have here a pendulum. Okay. Pretty much the same. Not exactly. Now I have a magnetic field. I will take this piece. Not much happens. I take this piece. It's entirely damp. This one can't establish effective eddy currents. Yet the field such that this one can. So you'll get the currents induced basically through the magnetic damp. Sounds good. Very cool. Here's what we looked at last time. I have just a coil of wire hooked across the voltmeter. And if you recall, if I took a magnet, which I don't have right now, and I put it in or pull it out, I would get a current. Okay? Here I have another coil of wire. And I'm simply going to put it on top of the other one, but you can assume they're insulated from each other. And this one, the top one, is hooked across a battery. And when I connect the battery, it's going to create a current loop, which will do create a magnetic field. So maybe it's not crazy, but again, you can take a current, changing current in one loop, and it will effectively talk to the other loop, right? It will induce the current in the other loop. So this, as you can imagine, can cause all sorts of aggravation in an electronic circuit. And it's we call it inductance, and we'll talk more about that today. But it's a source of frustration for electronics designers, because anything changing over here in principle will create a magnetic field which can screw around with what's going on in other places in the circuit. So a bit of a problem. Okay, so here I have a similar thing. I have a current loop in which I can create a powerful current. And I have a conducting loop that has a slice cut through it. And I'll put it around this current loop. This current loop has a big chunk of iron that's in it for reasons we'll talk about. Iron amplifies magnetic fields, so they're called electromagnets. Basically, what happens is if I put a field in iron, it will align iron atoms that tend to be unpaired but also have little magnetic fields. And we'll talk about that. And when you align them, you basically get a stronger and stronger magnetic field. So it's a way to enhance things. So when I turn on the field here, nothing much happens. And the reason that nothing much happens is because I have this loop that's incomplete. If I take a loop which is complete, so again, I'm inducing a current in this that opposes the field here, so you get opposite and that jumps. Induction's fun stuff. So you'll find a link on the website for a Java applet that has a loop. So we have a wire loop that goes in and out of a magnetic field, and that motion causes an induced current. This is happening at a fixed rate of speed, so it turns out that this is a constant slope. We'll calculate that in a minute. And you'll get the current induced in directions that are given by Lenz's law. So you might want to play with this. One of the things you'll notice is that if the flux isn't changing, nothing happens. Okay. But I can. Again, good for a party. All right, so you might want to play with this. So actually, let's look at that problem. So we have a field that's uniform going into the board. And I have a current loop like so. And let's say that it has a width of length L of L, and it has, at any given time, we'll say that it has a length X which is in the field. And we'll have this thing coming out of the field at speed V. Okay, so we've already sort of thought about this. If it is coming out of the field is going into the board, you want to increase that because by coming out, you're reducing the flux. You want to increase the flux, according to Lenz's law. So you're going to get a current that's induced clockwise as you're pulling it out of the field. If you want to know the size of that current, and for fun, we'll say that it has a resistance R here in the loop, just so you can talk easily about current. So the EMF goes as minus d phi m over dt, is minus d by dt of what is phi m? Phi m is going to be the magnitude of B times L times X at any given moment. And that's minus B times L times dx over dt, and that is V. So the induced EMF is minus BLV. The minus sign really is just giving you an indication of direction, that it's fighting the change that created it. And if you have a resistance in the loop, the current that you get is the EMF divided by the resistance, or BLV over R. So solenoids are, as you've already seen, current loops, which are sort of really short squat solenoids, if you want to think about it that way. Solenoids and current loops are really good ways to think about magnetic fields. So what I want to do is to think about a solenoid for a minute and talk about how induction works in a solenoid. So let's imagine that we have a solenoid, like so. And we'll say that this solenoid has n turns per unit length, and that each turn you can think of as a current loop of area A. Okay. And let's say that we have a current going through that thing. So if I have a current in this loop, what we calculated that you have a magnetic field inside the solenoid. In fact, it's confined inside the solenoid, which is why if it's an infinite solenoid. This one's not infinite, but we won't worry about the edge effects right now. But it's sort of like parallel plates for electric field. You can sort of confine the field in there. It's fairly easy to understand. So we've calculated that. So at any given point, if I have a current going through this solenoid, phi m is going to be equal to the magnetic field that's inside the solenoid times A. And earlier we calculated that the magnetic field inside the solenoid is uniform, and it's equal to mu 0 times n, number of turns per unit length, times I, and each loop gives you another area. So this whole thing should be multiplied by the area. Well, so the magnetic field that you have times n times gradient length times the area gives you the magnetic flux. So this actually, this would be for a single turn. I have the n turns per unit length in setting up the field, but this would be the magnetic flux for the single turn. So if I take a length L of the solenoid, then the magnetic flux through that length L is going to be mu 0 times n times I times A times the length I take times the number of turns per unit length. That basically tells you how often the flux is going through that solenoid, that wire, basically, because you're just repeating the loop. You okay with that? You don't look so okay with that. The solenoid is like having multiple loops, but they're all connected in one wire. Okay? So B times A, if I'm given a B, which is mu 0 times N times I, gives me the flux through a single loop. Alright? Now, in the solenoid, if I take a length of the solenoid, I effectively have a lot of loops added together. So if that wire is all hooked together, I'm multiplying the flux by the flux through each of those loops, if you want to think about it. And the number of loops I have is the number of turns per unit length times the length. Okay? So that gives you the flux through that portion of the solenoid. So one of the things I'd like you to notice is whether we're talking about a single loop or n loops, this magnetic flux is proportional to the current. Which should make sense. If I increase the current, I'm increasing the field that's going through the solenoid, so that's going to increase the flux. So note here that phi m is proportional to the current, and we will say that because there's a constant of proportionality, that since it's proportional, we'll say that phi m is equal to L times I. Where this L is a constant of proportionality. And in fact, mu 0 times N times A, you'll note that it depends only on geometry of the solenoid. And this constant we call the self-inductance. And the reason for that will become clear right now. So if I have a current going through a solenoid, and let's say that I change that current, If I change the current in the solenoid, it's going to change the magnetic field in the solenoid, and that's going to induce a current in the solenoid, which fights it. So I'll get some weird stuff going. So we say that I'll get an induced EMF that depends on the rate at which I change the current. The current creates the magnetic field. If what's relevant is how is the magnetic field changing, how is the flux changing, then that will change with as I change the current, right? So what's important is the rate at which the current is changing in terms of how the EMF gets induced. And L here is called the constant of self-inductance. So what that means is this is an induced EMF that you get inside this device because of the changing current that is happening inside that device. So in a funny way, it's sort of talking to itself. Okay. So this thing actually is a characteristic of the solenoid itself. It depends on geometry only, and it's called the self-inductance. And it has units, which are called Henrys, after Joseph Henry and MKS. So exactly how we use this, if you'll just bear with me for a minute, it'll become clear. So let's suppose I have a solenoid, and then somewhere else in space, I have another current loop. We'll call this 1, and we'll call this 2. And now, it's a little bit like what we were talking about a minute ago, one loop that talks to another. We can talk about the fact that if I change the current here, it will change the magnetic field, which basically, the solenoid produces a field. Let's say this isn't an infinite solenoid. Okay, produces a field that looks like this. Okay, and that will change the field going through this loop, which will induce an EMF in that loop. Okay, so instead of this one basically playing with itself, it now goes on a date and basically can talk to the its partner over here. So now if you think about it, if I change I in 1, this will give me a changing phi m in 2, which gives me an induced EMF in 2. Okay? So phi m in 2 is proportional to the current in 1. So now we say that phi m is equal to something that multiplies the current. It's a constant of proportionality. But now it's not talking to itself, so it's not the self-inductance. is talking to its date, so we call it mutual inductance. And so instead of L, we give it an M. Basically the same thing, but it's now one piece talking to another piece. So now what you have is that the EMF in 2 is equal to minus M DI 1 DT. Okay? So to sort of summarize it a little bit, if you have a current in something and it's changing, it will change the magnetic field that's going through it depending on its geometry. And so the magnetic flux is proportional to that current, and so the rate of change, the induced EMF, will depend on the rate of change of the current, and the constant you use to set that up is called constant of self-inductance. The same thing happens over here with two items, except you consider a change in current here. What does it do in terms of inducing a current over there? So you can imagine the flux of this one, the current changing here will change the flux going through that one, and it will depend on the current. Turns out that you could do it the other way too, and you have the same constant that describes them. So if I calculate the flux in 2 due to the current in 1, I have one constant of proportionality. And if I flip it around and say, what is the flux in 1 due to the current in 2, it turns out that you have the same constant of proportionality because the geometry between the two hasn't changed. This is known as the constant of mutual inductance. And so you get the EMF is basically the same thing right here. You have an M instead of an L. So mutual inductance would be something that, for example, can give you crosstalk in electronics and stuff. It can cause noise in your circuits because if you have something generating a magnetic field over here, it can cause currents to flow in your thing by basically changing the flux that's going through it. Also, one part of a circuit can sort of talk to another part of the circuit. So that would be basically mutual inductance. Typically, we do with inductance what we do with resistors in circuits. We count, we pretend that all the wires connecting the circuit are resistance-less, and then we put the resistance in these little pieces that we put in the circuit called resistors, and that's where you consider the resistance. Any circuit might also have inductance, and typically we think of it as a self-inductance, and we put it in one circuit element in the circuit. So let's imagine that we have a circuit where we now have an EMF. The circuit has some resistance and it has some inductance. And the symbol for an inductor is a little spring coil because it looks a lot like a solenoid. And a solenoid is sort of our classic device that has inductance. So inductance could in the real world be a little more complicated, but there are also devices that are sort of like that, that are inductors you can put in a circuit. And one of the ways in which the approximation that all the resistance is in these little devices is that very often that the resistors that you put in the circuit is much greater than the resistance you have in the wire. So it's not a bad approximation. The same is true typically for inductors. So what I'd like to do is to do a Kirchhoff's law sort of voltage sum around this thing. So as we go around the loop, the sum of the voltages have to be zero. So EMF minus IR minus LDI over DT is equal to zero. So this is sort of where that mathematics of the induction comes in. You have a piece in the differential equation that you get from doing the voltage sum that now depends on the change of the changing current. So to get us to do something interesting with this, one of the things I'd like to do is just multiply all the terms by the current. I mean, I don't know if I sat down and confronted this equation in a dark alley one night, the first thing I think to do is multiply it by current. But I know what I'm trying to do here, so just bear with me. So if we multiply all the terms by the current, and let me move the two negative terms to the other side. This left-hand term is now V times I. And we know that that's a power. That's the power output of the battery. Right? I squared R is also power dissipated in the resistor if you have a current in the thing. So, since those two units are power, then it must mean that this is actually, it must be a power as well. So what's going on? You've got basically the solenoid and you have a changing current. So the solenoid is sitting there. It's not getting hot the way a resistor does. So that when the resistor, you're shoving all its current through there, it's getting hot. So that's where the energy is going. Where's the energy going in the solenoid or this inductor? If I'm putting a current in there, then I'm creating a magnetic field. So that must be where this energy is going. So this has to be the rate of change of the energy in the B field that's inside this solenoid, because there's just nothing else there. So that's a little bit of a step, because now we're saying that the magnetic field stores energy or has energy in it. But that maybe shouldn't be a huge surprise, because we've already figured that out with the electric field as an energy density. So let's see if we can actually figure out what the energy density is in the magnetic field. This term is the chain, if we interpret it as the magnetic field energy, this term, the right-hand term in that equation, then is the change in the energy stored in the magnetic field, which I'll call U sub B, with respect to time. And that's L times I times DI over DT. So these are both derivatives with respect to time, so basically I'll integrate the time out. So I get dUB is equal to LI DI. And let me assume for simplicity, that for this circuit, the current goes from zero to some large I. And what I'd like to do is to integrate the energy in the magnetic field as the current goes from zero to some fixed value I. So the total energy stored in the magnetic field is going to be the integral from zero to I of Li dI, which is going to be L times I squared over 2, where I squared is the big I, or 1/2 L I squared. This is pretty analogous to the 1/2 CV squared that you get with capacitors. So if you were to ask, for a given current, how much energy is stored in the inductor, or in the field that's in that inductor, it's going to be 1/2 Li squared. Okay? So if I know I have energy in the field, and I know how big it is, and I have it in a solenoid, which is a geometry I can understand, I can look at what the energy density is in the electric field. So I know for a solenoid that B is equal to mu 0 times N times I inside and 0 outside. So if we have a solenoid which has a current I N turns per length, and let's say that it has a length L, we're going to ignore the edge effects. Let's define this script UB as the energy density in the B field. So UB is going to be the total energy in the magnetic field for this device divided by its volume, which will be the area of the solenoid times its length. So this is going to be, if we have a current I, then it's going to be 1/2 times L I squared divided by A times L. And earlier, for the solenoid, magnetic flux is whatever here multiplies I. So the self-inductance for a solenoid is mu 0 times A times L times N squared. I squared, this is over A times L. So this is 1/2 times mu 0 times I. Mu 0 times I squared times N squared. And mu 0 times I times N is the magnetic field in the solenoid itself. So this is the magnitude of B squared over 2 mu 0. Remember earlier we had the energy density in the electric field is epsilon naught over 2 times E squared. So we have something very analogous in the magnetic field. Energy density in it. And just like capacitors can store energy, when you create the electric field in there, you're storing energy in inductors, but you're storing it in the form of a magnetic field. So we used a very specific example, just like we did with the capacitor and the electric field. We used a parallel plate capacitor with the electric field, and we found that the electric field in there has energy, and it has an energy density here. We used a very specific example, but in the end, you get an answer that is the energy density in the electric field from the magnetic field. It doesn't matter how it's set up, what it came from. It's not limited to that geometry. You just use that geometry to sort of extract this density. But if I have a magnetic field, it has an energy density, and it goes as the field strength squared divided by 2 mu 0. Okay with that? So, you look like you're falling asleep. Sorry. Sometimes I get up here and feel slow, but it shouldn't be slow. This is a really cool topic. So let me tell you where we're going. We'll do some neat stuff along the way, too. If I have a wire, okay, and I have a changing electric field in the wire, which I can create with some generator or something, right? It will generate a changing current. If I have a changing current, it will generate a changing magnetic field. If I have a changing magnetic field, it generates a changing EMF, right, which effectively could induce a current. And so this... So imagine that I have a handful of electric charges, and I just do this. Okay? Then this moving charge will create, in the space around it, a changing magnetic field, which induces an EMF, but a way to think about that is you have to have an electric field if you're going to have an induced EMF, right? Because that's what you mean when you talk about an induced EMF, is that if I go around a loop, it takes work. It only takes work if there's a field there. So if I have this charge, I create a changing magnetic field in space, which then induces a changing electric field in space. But I already found if I have a changing electric field, it induces a changing magnetic field, which induces a changing electric field. And this whole phenomenon basically propagates outward, and we'll calculate the speed, and it travels at the speed of light. And it is light. That's the essence of it. Is that cool or what? So we'll see this mathematically. But Maxwell was the first one who sort of threw up equations and was able to pull all this together and actually calculate the speed of propagation and realize that it was light, which had to be one of the most fabulous moments in the history of mankind. Right? A little bit like when Newton figured out he had the law for how the planets move. There are just a few moments like that. It's absolutely spectacular. So, all right. All right, so we can make circuits with these different devices, and they'll have very different characteristics. So let's look at a circuit that contains an inductor and a resistor. So we call that an LR circuit. So if we look at this and we do the voltage sum around this circuit, we get that the EMF minus LDI over DT minus RIR. So we've already looked at this one. That's equal to zero. This is just a differential equation in I, so you can solve it. This isn't the differential equations class, so I'm not going to drag you through the solution. I just want you to understand and know what the solution is. So if you solve this equation for the current, the solution you'll get is EMF over R times 1 minus E to the minus T R over L. Sorry, we have no capacitor in this one. So we define TL as the inductive time constant. So if you look at this, if you recall when we had a charging capacitor, we had an equation that looked almost identical to this, except it was T over RC. And if you recall, so this equation will give us a behavior that looks a whole lot like that other solution. If we look at I as a function of time, it will give us a curve that looks like this. It starts out at zero because e to the zero is one and one minus one up here is zero. And it will rise asymptotically as this exponential drops with increasing time. And I'm subtracting less and less from that 1, and I'll asymptotically rise to a level, which is this E over R. This piece is just V is equal to IR. So it's telling you that in time, the inductor stops fighting the current. So what's happening is, initially, your current's changing with time. It has to establish the B field in the inductor, which takes energy. And remember, this induced current basically fights the field that's being produced. So the inductor effectively keeps this current from building too fast. Until the current reaches sort of this steady state, when it has a steady state, you have no... The induced EMF due to the inductor is zero. So it basically then looks like a V equals IR circuit because the inductor sort of, you've established the field in it, you're no longer fighting the current. And so it goes asymptotically to what you would expect with a V equals IR. But notice that now instead of RC being the time constant, we have R over L as effectively it's L over R has time units. It's a time constant, and you can think of this time constant in much the same way that you thought of the RC time constant. Remember, for RC, it was how much charge is on the capacitor. In this case, it's what is the value of the current. So it's a little different, but a lot of your intuition can be the same. So the asymptotic value that you reach here is E over R. And if you have a small TL, then you will rise very fast. And if you have a very large TL, then it will be very slow. Okay, so if you have a much larger inductance, then, for example, you can think of it as if it will fight the development of that current much longer. So let's suppose that we have let's suppose that we've hooked the CMF across an inductor and a resistor, and we let it sit for a long time. So that means it achieves its sort of asymptotic value. And now we take the battery out and short circuit the inductor across the resistor. So when I say at some large time t later, that is my way of telling you that you can consider the initial condition such that the inductor's magnetic field is that the current is as big as it's going to get, which means the initial current you can think of in the inductor is this epsilon over R. But now you pull the battery out and you short circuit the inductor. So you have this situation where you have created this magnetic field, but now I instantly stop the current, or I drop. Okay? So now it's going to give a changing current in the inductor, which is going to give a changing EMF. So things get sort of complicated. So we're going to short the L across the R. So now we have a circuit that looks like, I hope it doesn't look like that. So if we now go around this current loop and do a sum, we get 0 is equal to plus IR plus L DI over DT. We just don't have the MF in there. So the current if we solve this is EMF over R times E to the minus T over TL. You can do that solution, I think, easily enough. So this now is very similar to the discharging capacitor across the resistor. We have an exponential drop in the current. Again, it's characterized by in time by this T tau, this TL. And it starts out as EMF over R. So if we look at the current as a function of time, here's our value of EMF over R. It's going to drop off exponentially, like so. And if I have a large time constant, then it's going to be slower drop off. And if I have still going to be exponential, but if I have a small TL, it's going to drop off slower. So a way to think about this is I have a magnetic field and I'm in the conductor and I'm stopping the current. So that means I have a big change in the current, which is going to change the magnetic flux. So I get an induced EMF in this thing. And that basically will keep the current from instantly dropping to zero. The current is trying to drop, so I'll induce an EMF in such a way that I fight that. So this inductor basically is going to use the energy that's stored in its magnetic field to effectively keep the current going, in a sense. until it runs out of energy. And so that's why effectively having the inductor in here sort of softens the drop in the current, if you want to think of it that way. And the bigger the inductor, the slower that drop off is. Okay? All right, I think that's a good place to stop. So hopefully see many of you today at 3:00.